much as possible, I have someone else doing that to keep me free to do the writing and the planning.
Since we mentioned your website, why don't you give us the names of some of your websites, the URL addresses?
Well, the two most important I'd like people to know about are gmarketing.com.
Gmarketing.com.
That's the biggest one. And the one that's the most fascinating is called GuerrillaMarketingAssociation.com, spelled G-U-E-R-R. There's two R's, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A, GuerrillaMarketingAssociation.com. And that describes the most exciting thing we've ever offered. For an author, when he writes a book, my book appears in Barnes & Noble or Borders or Amazon, but there's five things in the book I wish I hadn't said because I didn't know those things at the time I wrote the book. And I also think of five things I didn't put in the book because I didn't know them at the time. They just are recent developments. The Guerrilla Marketing Association enables me to publish information monthly. So to really keep serious small business owners up to speed, they have a coaching forum where they get to ask questions and I get to answer them, or one of 39 or 40 trained guerrilla marketing coaches. And we have a weekly phone call every Wednesday evening, a one-hour call where anybody can ask me any kind of questions. So rather than writing a book, my last book is called Guerrilla Marketing for Free. It came out in September of last year. But now, instead of a book, we are doing the Guerrilla Marketing Association, which lets me relate to the members and give them advice they can act on. Some man last month told us he wrote a book he wants to get to the bestseller list at Barnes & Noble. How should we do it? We gave him suggestions. Last week he told us now he's number one at Barnes & Noble. And then a phone call, an hour phone call, and you can't do that with a book. You can only do that back and forth with people in real time.
Do you record the phone calls?
Yes. If you join the GuerrillaMarketingAssociation.com, all the phone calls that we've ever had in our history are published there.
How many of them are there? How many hours?
We started doing the phone calls in April of 2003. We have a phone call for every week from April 2003 until last night, February the 18th, 2004. So that's a lot of phone calls.
Yeah, and they last about an hour each?
They're an hour each, but people can listen to them and go back and listen to them over and over and over again. The calls are exactly 1 hour.
What kind of service do you use to record the calls? The conference calling service?
Yes, we use a conference service out of Atlanta.
Is it M3?
It's MP3, yes.
Okay. What has been your most successful marketed product? And with that product, was there any one way in which you marketed it that stands out? That's from David Jennings, Melbourne, Australia again.
The second book I wrote was called Secrets of Successful Freelancing. I'll say it again, Secrets of Successful Freelancing. It was 43 pages long. It was sold for $10. And I ran ads in the back of writing magazines and artist magazines and photographer magazines. Every time I would spend $100 in ads, I would get $1,000 in book sales. And so that really worked. But then I found that there was a list of freelancers, a list of 10,000 of them. So I wrote a one-page letter to the, this is before the days of email, to the 10,000 freelancers in the United States. And I offered them the book, a $10 book. I told them if they buy it and don't like it, send it back, and I'll send them their $10 back plus a dollar just for giving it a shot. So what happened is that 33% of the people, 3,330 people, ordered the book.
Wow.
And that was an amazing response rate. So I thought, I may as well now do a mailing to 1 million freelancers. But I found out I had purchased the only list of freelancers that existed.
And these were freelance writers.
Freelance writers, art directors, photographers, accountants. So I just broadened the idea from the word freelancers to anybody, and I wrote a book called Earning Money Without a Job. I identified about 150 ways that people do freelance other than the freelancing methods I just mentioned. That was a breakthrough success because it was at a time in the 70s that people were beginning to consider the idea of small business. Big companies were laying off hundreds of thousands of people at a time. And here I was telling people how easy it is to start your own business. And then, of all things, in response to students, because my books led to me teaching a course at Berkeley, my students asked me to recommend a book on marketing for people with big dreams but limited budgets. And I couldn't find such a book anywhere, so I wrote that book, and I called it Guerrilla Marketing. That book took on a life of its own. So by being responsive to the needs of society, these are the people who were unemployed, and then it's to the responsible needs of my students. These are people with the big dreams but the empty pockets. By responding to those people, I had the biggest success I'd ever had. It's just what you said at the beginning, Michael. I found out what people needed, and then I created a product for those people. I wasn't thinking in terms of making money at all. I was only thinking in terms of giving people what they needed. It wasn't my opinion of what they needed. It was what they said they needed.
What stimulated you to write the freelancing book? What got that rolling?
When I realized that I had been working a year on my own, from my own home, 3 days a week, I realized there was nothing special about me, and anybody could do that. So I wrote a book about it. That's what Secrets of Successful Freelancing was. My nephew said, well, Jay, you wrote that as an instruction manual for yourself. But the truth is, I wrote it, it was about what I was doing. It was exactly 100% about how I was able to pull off working a three-day week and spending a lot of time with my wife and daughter and becoming a better and better skier as the years advanced, because I had so much time on the slopes on weekdays. There were no lift lines. And I think the most successful thing I ever learned was to be responsive to people's needs. And we started our conversation today by you telling me that was your opinion. I also think that it's not a matter of working less, but working more effectively. I don't think I work any less than other people. I just don't waste my time in meetings or reading memos or having unnecessary conversations. I work about as much now as I did when I worked full-time at an advertising agency.
Okay, I've got some more descriptive words. You ready?
I'm ready.
Number 11 is traditional.
I would say 3.
Paced.
P-A-S-E. I would say 4.
Self-assured.
5.
Outgoing.
5.
Modest.
3.
Passive.
1.
By the book.
1.
Authoritative.
4.
Contemplative.
2.
And adaptable.
5.
Okay, great. Here's a question from John Eckloff. What are the 2 best books on any topic that you've read recently other than yours?
Oh, boy. Okay. Al Reese, R-E-I-L-R-I-E-S, wrote a book called Focus. And the book Focus talks about famous corporations that everybody's heard of. And it talks about humiliating the stupid and expensive mistakes that they've made.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who reads his book will feel a whole lot better about themselves when they realize that some of these big companies really got in trouble because of what's called corporate ego, and because they lost their focus and they started diversifying into areas way beyond what they ought to be doing. That's one of the better books I've read on business in a long time. I'm also fascinated with the book Fast Food Nation, which I read last year. Fast Food Nation was a tell-all book about fast food of all kinds in the United States and the differences between the franchises. And John asked for 2 books. I want to add one more because I'm reading everything by John Krakauer. It's a true adventure. After that, I read Iger Dreams, which is about mountain climbing stories that he writes about. Then I read Into the Wild, which he told about an ill-fated expedition a man had into Alaska. Just finished a book called Under the Banner of Heaven, which is sort of a tell-all book about the Mormons in the year 2004. And those are fascinating books by John Krakauer. But I would put Focus and Fast Food Nation as 2 of the best books I've read in a long, long time.
Okay, great. Thanks for sharing that. Here's a question. I don't have who it's by, but it says, you have told thousands of individuals personally and in groups what to do and how to do your techniques. And the evidence is overwhelmingly, actually mind-blowing, that your ideas work. How is it so few people follow through and apply these insights to fulfill their ambitions? And what, in your view, are the different stumbling blocks they create for themselves?
Gosh, what brilliant questions. The people who find stumbling blocks and the people who don't consider this idea of the ideas I write about are the people who would give a 5 when you would say the word tradition. They are bound by the tradition of their parents and their grandparents, and they think that life is supposed to be a 9-to-5 job. And they think life characterized by having too much month left over at the end of the money, and characterized by the concept of a job. They don't look beyond that idea. They say that if you were to put 10 tunnels down and hide a piece of cheese at the end of one of the tunnels and put a mouse at the end of the other end, the mouse will find the cheese. And then if you move the cheese, the mouse will again find the cheese. They say if you take a human being and put the human being at the end of the tunnels and hide a piece of cheese, the human being will find the cheese. But if you move the cheese, the human being will never again find the cheese. They keep going down the same tunnel. This is called unemployment. It's called unable to make ends meet. But it's the tradition that they learned when they were in school. No one talks about self-improvement when you're in grammar school or high school. And even in colleges, everything is oriented to a career and not the idea of freelancing and being your own person and running your own company or having multiple streams of income. So I think tradition and family expectation is what gets in the way of most people. That's why they don't think in terms of being free and working according to the structure that they set and setting an income that they want for themselves rather than what the boss says and giving themselves raises whenever they feel that they deserve it rather than being at the mercy of somebody else and working the hours that is comfortable for them and their body clocks rather than the hours that has traditionally been in that business or that office or that factory.
I see. Do you do any writing or work with children to believe in entrepreneurship or believe in their ideas? Any projects like that you currently do?
You know, only while my daughter was in school and I would speak at her grammar school and her junior high school and her high school when I talked about the life of an entrepreneur. I haven't done any since then to children. Although people who don't know what I'm talking about and this idea of structuring their own work existence, they are like children in my eyes.
That makes sense. It all comes to a matter of them believing that it's really possible.
Yes.
Here's a question by Pam McInnes from LaGrange, Illinois. She wants to know, how do you get your ideas on what to research to find the next topic you will write about?
God, what great questions. Kim, I subscribe to a lot of internet newsletters, marketing newsletters, marketingprofs.com and sherpa.com. And I'm on a lot of mailing lists that are not considered spam. When I get spam, which everybody gets, I figured that one out of every 20 will have a good idea in it. The other 19 I can click away after checking them, but the 20th one might have a gem in it. And when I go through newsletters, I just spend maybe 5 minutes maximum, but I'm looking for the titles of something that might be of intrigue to me and my readers. And if I'm intrigued by it, then I'm assuming that my readers, my audience, will be too. So by doing a lot of scanning, by reading a daily newspaper, by reading some of a national weekly news magazine on a regular basis, by watching the news every day, and by subscribing to certain sources of marketing information, that's how I'm able to get new ideas and keep up. Plus, I play poker on Monday nights. I've got a poker game that's 18 years old, and all these guys in my game, not only do they want to take my money, but they want to give me ideas that I can put into my books because they know I'm a writer. They know I write columns and have a newsletter, and they know that I write books on a once-a-year basis, so they give me ideas. Friends of mine in business send me clippings or send me something that they, a website that they thought was of interest to me. So I find there's lots of good ideas out there, and I have a lot of help from a lot of friends who just gratis send me good ideas.
That's great. So let me ask you this. Let's say you come up with a great idea for a book, or you maybe, are you working on one right now that isn't public yet? Are you working on a book currently?
I have envisioned a new book, but I haven't started on it yet. I can't until I start doing it.
All right, so let's say you have that idea and you do it and you complete it in a couple months. What's your first step to market that book? What are you going to do after it's written, it's edited? Do you print them up before you market it? Tell me a little bit about the process.
I emailed the manuscript to my publisher. My publisher is in the East Coast. They take care of producing the book, getting it into bookstores, getting it listed with Amazon, and getting it reviewed.
So do you have a contract with your publisher?
Yes.
Who, can I ask who your publisher is?
It's Houghton Mifflin.
And how long have you been with them?
I've been with them since 1984.
So have they done all your books or just some of them?
John Wiley has done maybe 40% of my books, 50% have been done by Houghton Mifflin, and 10% by Avon or New American Library.
So if you came up with this new book, are you under contract with this current publisher, or could you present it to any one of your previous publishers?
My contract says I have to first show it to my current publisher. And if they say no, which they have sometimes, Then I give it to another publisher, and then my current publisher says, why were we so dumb as to say no? Guerrilla marketing books seem to sell increasingly with time.
So when you set this deal up, everyone has dreams of selling a million books, and you've sold 16 million.
Yes.
So tell someone who maybe doesn't know about what this whole situation is like, and let's say you land a deal with a publisher, what kind of offer can you expect from a publisher, and how is it structured, and how do you make money, and is it something you can negotiate? Can you get into some of the details?
Yes, I sure can. First of all, I use a literary agent. So my agent, who represents a lot of different authors and knows a lot of publishers on a first-name basis, he takes 15% of anything that I get. That means he then comes up with how much money I'll get because he wants to get the most for me because he gets 15% of that. And he knows what my publisher wants at the time.
Did you have a literary agent before you had a publisher?
No, my first book I self-published. My second and my third book I self-published. And finally, one of my books was reviewed, and then a literary agent called me and said, you have an agent? And I said, what is that? And he said, well, I will represent you to publishers and get you more money and better deals and get you to be a Book of the Month Club selection and get you in all the big bookstores.
No, I got you.
So I said, okay. And I noticed when I signed a contract with the publisher, the agent goes over it first and makes about 16 changes. And they're all changes in my favor, and I would not have thought to make those changes if I didn't have an agent.
So you would advise anyone to get a good agent?
Yes, it definitely is worth the 15% you give them. They then try to get the most money for your book, and they jump on the publisher to get them to publicize your book. But the truth is, publishers, they usually get a little author tour for you. Go. So I get to go to maybe 3 or 4 cities and speak at bookstores and speak to groups of booksellers, but then you're kind of on your own. I give talks. I give talks to chambers of commerce. I give talks to national conventions, and I talk about guerrilla marketing. I grant interviews to anybody who wants to talk about guerrilla marketing. I write columns and I write articles about guerrilla marketing. If I see that somebody is copying my ideas for guerrilla marketing, giving talks or teaching courses or writing pamphlets or articles, instead of suing them, I call them or email them and I compliment them on their taste in selecting guerrilla marketing, and I offer them discounts on books or memberships in our association. And so I don't believe in suing because I know that time spent in court is deducted from the time spent you spend in heaven. So I spend no time in court. I never sue anybody. I encourage everybody who wants to copy me. And by doing that, I have grown the guerrilla marketing brand to the point that it's in 39 languages now, which means, Michael, I don't understand 38 editions of my own book. But the world is embracing small business more than ever before, and as a result, they have the needs for what I write about, guerrilla marketing. I just happened to write the right book at the right time, at the time that society was becoming more enlightened and evolved and moving out of that job, realizing that's not as secure as they thought it was, and they're opting more for self-employment that is easier than ever before because of the Internet, which does make everything a global market. Last night, we made our telephone call for the association, and we had people on from pretty much around the world on our phone call because it's become truly a global society. And I find that by speaking, writing, that will make the books sell. Also, when you write a book, you've got to have in mind what happens if this book is a success. And that means what happens is you've got to have another book because people want one. So I've always asked that. I've always had that idea. And my agent has always pushed me in that direction. He always says, Jay, if this book is successful, what are you going to write next? And he causes me to think in that way. So as a result, I've always had a next book in mind. I do now. But right now, I am doing this interactive book, which we call the Guerrilla Marketing Association. And I'm finding it's a very gratifying way for me and for all readers to talk to me one-on-one, and for me to talk to them and to learn from them, to learn what they are interested in, what they care about, just as you did when you sent questionnaires to your audience, to your people, Michael.
Okay, that's excellent. So the publisher is the one who decides what languages it's going to be published in?
Yes.
And they take care of all that?
Yes, and the publisher is supposed to take care of all publicizing of your book. But everybody who's written a book knows that they just plain don't do that. So that's why we wrote a book a couple of years ago called Guerrilla Marketing for Writers.
That's great.
Which shows writers who have written the book, okay, you want to make your book a bestseller, here's how to do it.
Right. Now, let's go back to the time you wrote that one-page direct mail sales letter and sent it out to those 10,000 freelancers. That's a pretty incredible response. Now, I don't know what you make on each book, but what can someone expect to make if their agent negotiates a half-decent deal for what do you make on a book? And then when you look at that, with your success as a copywriter, and you, I'm sure you have a good understanding of mailing lists. I mean, there's writers who can sell millions of books, like Agora Publishing and some of the other big publishing houses. Have you ever had any desire to do that, and or does your contract keep you from doing that?
Well, my contract keeps me from doing that, and my publisher treats me so well that I like to maintain my loyalty to them.
Right.
But a question you brought up twice, and I should have answered the first time, and this is the real honest-to-goodness answer, and of all the things I'm saying during this conversation, I think this is one of the most important, because it's so easy to write a book these days.
Right.
How much money did I make from my first book? And the answer is that the publisher gave me an advance of $10,000. And I would say that I made about $3 to $5 million from the book because of the doors that it opened.
Exactly.
Because of the speaking invitations that it led to, because of the offers to write columns and articles and conduct seminars and teach courses. It opened so many doors that I don't measure the size of the royalty. That's minor league by comparison to the opportunities that unfold once you have authored a book. And these days, you don't need an agent, you don't need a publisher. Publishing on demand, just look it up on Google, is technology. Here's what happens, and here's what it's like. A person I know wanted to write a book for financial planners. He didn't help him. He wanted to call it Guerrilla Marketing for Financial Planners. His name is Grant Hicks. I said, okay. He wrote the book, and he said, Jay, do we have to take this to your agent? I said, well, we have to show it to him first. I'm contractually bound. He has to show it to my publisher. So he showed it to my agent. My agent thought that it was too limited to market financial advisors. He showed it to my publisher. My publisher thought it's too limited to market just financial advisors, because my books generally have a more wide appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So Grant Hicks found out about publishing on demand, and now, mind you, I'm telling you the truth, this is what goes on now in 2004, he calls a phone number for a company called Trafford, T-R-A-F-F-O-R-D, and he says, print one copy of my book and mail it to such and such an address. And Trafford prints up a copy of the book. It's gorgeous. It looks as good as anything you find at Borders or Barnes & Noble. It's beautiful color cover, beautifully produced paper stock, gorgeously set type and bound. They mail it to one person. They charge him $10.
Unbelievable.
From publish, print, find the book, and mail it, he charges $25 for the book. So he has zero investment. Trafford is not like the old days where you've got to print up 5,000 copies. They
right.
say, hey, we'll do it one at a time.
Right. Now, is Trafford one of the biggest and best?
They're the one that Grant Hicks found. I don't know if they're the biggest or the best. I'm just giving you a true story of something that happened to a friend of mine from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And his real costs were $10 to print the book and mail it, and $25 is what he charges. He said also, you know, I could pay the same $10 and charge $85 for the book. He says, but I try to charge what I think it's worth. They think it's worth $25. So technology is such that you can now print up your books one at a time, don't have to give 10% to an agent, don't have to worry about getting it into Barnes & Noble or Borders if you have a mailing list online. But if not, and you want to get some from Barnes & Noble and Borders, then it's going to be a much easier job for you if you do have a book distributor or a publisher. And life really becomes easy if writing is what you've chosen to do, if you do have a literary agent. Because there's lots of things to do, and you want to be freed up to do only the things that you love to do, by speaking and writing.
Okay, I got 10 more descriptive words. Gregarious.
I would say 4.
Meditative.
I would say 2.
Flexible.
4.
Fast-paced.
5.
Methodical.
5.
Talkative.
3.
Relaxed.
3.
Agreeable.
5.
Conservative.
3.
Restless.
3.
Okay, that's great. Okay, another question from Paul Guthrow of Mound, Minnesota. These days, consumers are being bombarded by commercial messages. They're everywhere, even in the restrooms. Consumers can't escape. What is the most cost-effective way to break through this clutter and make an impact on a potential customer?
God, Paul, thank you for asking such a brilliant question. You're right. We are being bombarded with more messages now than at any other time in history, and it's going to get worse, which is why guerrilla marketing now preaches the idea of consent marketing, and that means don't try to make the sale with your marketing. It's just too hard these days. Instead, only try to gain consent for people to receive more marketing materials from you. Most people will withhold their consent. This is a good thing. Those are good people. It means you can save your money by not mailing to those people or not contacting those people who are not interested in you. A small percentage will give you their consent. You can focus your marketing efforts on broadening their level of consent. Here's an example. A woman runs the most successful summer camp in New York State. She runs little ads in the camping directories in the back of normal magazines that have camping directories. Does she try to sell the camping experience? No. All she tries to do is to get people to send for her video. She has a booth at the camping shows that inevitably spring up in the Northeast about this time of year. And does she try to sell the camping experience at her booth at the camping show? The answer is no, not at all. All she tries to do is get people to send for her free video or take her free video home. When the people take the video home and they view it, they see trained counselors and happy campers. They see wonderful equipment, beautiful settings. Does that video attempt to sell the camping experience? No, it doesn't. All it tries to do is to get the people who own the video now call for a free in-home appointment. 84% of the people who make an appointment end up signing their child up for that summer camp for that year and probably for the next year and probably for the year after that. And not just that kid, but that kid's maybe brothers or sisters or classmates or cousins. So that woman who practices consent marketing invests very little in the marketing process. She breaks through the clutter because she does not try to make the sale. All she does is offer something free and valuable, and then she builds on that consent, and she's realistic enough to understand that everyone in the world is not going to be her market. Her market is going to be just a small segment of the universe, but that small segment is enough for her to have the most successful summer camp in New York State. And you can be sure there's a lot of competition out there. And smart people these days are no longer aiming to make the sale, but just to gain consent. And the most practical piece of advice I can give is...
This is the end of part two. Please continue to part three.